You know, Steve used to say to me, and he used to say this a lot, "Hey, Johnny, here's a dopey idea." And sometimes they were really dopey. Sometimes they were truly dreadful. But sometimes they took the air from the room and they left us both completely silent. Bold, crazy, magnificent ideas. Or quiet, simple ones, which in their subtlety, their detail, they were utterly profound.
About what?
Have you not heard about Silk Road?
Don't do it now. Tell him in a minute.
I have no idea what it is.
Good, even better.
Oh, you both don't. Okay, this is awesome then.
Okay. Hello! And welcome to the CallCast, the best 30-minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. I'm your host, Erfan Elijah. I'm Erfan Bot, and I'm joined by my friends, Apple enthusiasts, fitness enthusiasts, Leander Caney, the very good-looking Leander Caney. Hey, Leander, welcome.
Hey, Erfan. Hey.
How's it going?
Good.
Good. I've also got the very good-looking Buster Heine.
Hey.
And the very good-looking Alex E. Heath. See, I'm an equal opportunity complimenter here. Welcome back to the show, gents. One of my favorite times of the week is getting to talk with you guys.
It's very kind of you. I'm swearing this week.
You've been actually really good, so I've got nothing to complain about.
Yeah, complete.
You've been a total gentleman. Not like Buster, who dropped the SH, I think, two episodes ago. Don't think I forgot. Hey, I do want to mention this show brought to you by the fine folks at Squarespace.com. Squarespace, who has everything you need to create a modern website and to create it fast. We've been talking about Squarespace for many months now. There's a reason everyone loves Squarespace. They get you up and running really quick. And not only are you going to have a website up in mere moments after signing up, which is totally free and doesn't even require a credit card, but their templates that you use are beautiful and look great on mobile devices, a computer. Squarespace works a bunch of magic in the background to make your website look great on every device that visits. So head on over to squarespace.com, sign up for a free trial. We'll talk about how to save 10% off your order a little later in the show. But first, let's start with this. Buster, before we hit record, when we were going to express how we truly feel about all things, you asked me about Silk Road, and I have no idea what that is. And you said it was weird and interesting. So please do tell, what is Silk Road?
The Silk Road is basically a magical website that you can access via your Macintosh computer. But you can't use Safari. You have to use a special internet browser called Tor.
Oh.
And so what Silk Road is it's basically the Amazon of drugs. And all transactions are done via Bitcoins because Bitcoins are supposed to be like an anonymous type of currency, although it's not really anonymous.
No, as the owner just found out today.
Yeah, as he was being carted off by the FBI.
Yeah, he actually did get carted off. But
he did.
Fascinating.
He did, I know. The government shut down, too. Apparently, they didn't shut down the FBI, though.
But Silk Road, they did over $1 billion in revenue, man.
Wow. Like, we're in the wrong business.
Bitcoin values. Yeah.
So I can't believe I'm just now hearing about this. Gosh.
Yeah. No, it's an amazing, pretty awesome website, but you can't go to it anymore because the feds just took it down. They took it down because the guy who runs it apparently put a hit out. Because you from Silk Road, you could buy anything. You could buy cocaine, heroin. You could hire an assassin to go kill somebody.
You hire an assassin to go kill someone to get your cocaine?
You could, yes.
I'm looking at screenshots and it's Crystal Rocks, Valium,
and it just shows up via FedEx, you know, it comes
yeah.
Wow.
A vacuum sealed bag just so like there's no odor or anything and it just shows up at your house and enjoy your drug supply.
MDMA, ecstasy, all sorts of stuff.
All Leander's favorite stuff.
And supposedly, you know, the feds had been like buying stuff off of it for years and tracking stuff, and they said the quality was pretty high.
Well, they nicked him by the stupidest reasons, right? Because didn't they just did a routine open up on a parcel at the border, and they found a bunch of fake IDs.
Huh.
And they,
so apparently you could buy fake IDs on there too?
Well, mm-hmm. Yep. I guess, yeah. And they tracked it to this address in San Francisco, and then they found it was Dread Pirate Roberts' apartment. What's his real name?
Dread Pirate Roberts?
Oh, that's what he goes
Ross, Ross Ulbricht?
Yeah, and so then they find the server. There's the server in his apartment.
So he was running all this off a server in his house?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Apparently.
I'm not exactly a security expert, is he?
No,
the whole concept behind it was supposed to be that it's on like a Tor browser, which you're accessing via other people on the Tor network, so you're not traced to his website, and so it was supposed to all be anonymous. And
meanwhile, the return address on the box is like Silk Highway, San Francisco, Washington, yeah. Closet 5.
Right, exactly.
So you can walk right back there.
Is Silk Road, I mean, because all of the transactions happen in bitcoins and over like $1 billion worth of bitcoins have flowed through it. Bitcoin value is like tanked this morning ever since they've talked about it, because it basically Silk Road was underpinning the whole value of the Bitcoin system. It's
the only thing valuable, right? They were trading.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. So the poor Winklevi twins are on their uppers.
Not again.
Right? Yeah, no. Too bad.
Hey, I never understood what Bitcoin was or why people were still talking about it. I mean, I understood that it was a digital currency, but it's been around for years, mm-hmm. and I never understood why, because I've never met anyone that actually uses it. I guess I was looking at the wrong crowd. I was looking at tech people.
Right.
What I needed to be doing is going to Burning Man, where
yeah,
all the currency.
Wanted to buy some ecstasy.
Right. Everyone's using the Bitcoin app.
There are some weird places that accept Bitcoins, aren't there? Like,
there are in San Francisco. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a coffee shop down the street here. I think I stumbled on its website and it was like, we accept Bitcoins.
Like a coffee shop in San Francisco. Like anywhere else in America.
Though. Yeah, I was going to say a coffee shop in San Francisco.
Yeah, when he said we accept Bitcoin, do you like open his eyes real wide and then start winking at you really exaggerated? He's like, this is a coffee shop, sir. Right, exactly. We only accept Bitcoin.
Right.
No cash allowed. Yeah, Leander was like, that's the best muffin I've ever had.
That's right. Well, that's what in the French Connection, it was pizza joints, right? They were all through New York. They were fronts for heroin.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So, yeah, it wouldn't be unprecedented.
Hey, is the idea... Sorry, go ahead, Alex.
No, I was just going to say the things you learn on the cult cast.
Yes, right. Yeah, somehow this was Mac-related. How do we make that loose affiliation that this should go on an Apple podcast? I don't recall. It's lost. Yeah. That's fine. It was still fascinating nonetheless. Hey, so stay tuned. I want to just tell everyone to stay tuned to the very end. We have, if you remember from last week, I announced that we're going to be broadcasting one of my favorite Steve Jobs appearances. This is in honor of his passing. As of October 5th, probably when you are hearing this, it will have been 2 years since his passing. And this is just... in my opinion, a wonderful broadcast. I had to get permission to use it, and I found it to be really inspiring, and I do listen to it several times a year. And it's kind of foreboding, because he does talk about his cancer in the speech, and really wonderful. So we'll put that in at the end. But I thought this would be a great opportunity to kind of think about Steve Jobs, or I guess post-Steve Jobs Apple, and to maybe offer up our thoughts on where we think the company is at, where we think they're headed now that he's gone. There was a lot of, for lack of a better word, fear that Apple was not going to be able to survive him leaving. And of course, everyone was wondering if Tim Cook could handle the job. Leander, I'm interested in what you think, because you wrote the book. You wrote the book on Steve Jobs. You know what was inside his brain.
Gosh.
on Amazon,
you know,
now.
I did a TV interview with Bloomberg West, right? I was just emailing this guy that got sort of Robert Bruner, who was the old designer there. Mm-hmm. He went on Bloomberg West on Friday, and he was complaining to me that he got cut off before – he was asked this question. He got cut off before he could – he got ambushed, right? He got asked, mm-hmm. he got asked all these questions he didn't think he was going to be asked. They said, oh, no, we won't talk about Apple. The first thing they do is ask him about Apple and they got the iPhone. And when I was on that show, like, I was on there to talk about Steve or something like that. And the host said, you wrote inside Steve's brain. What's he thinking right now?
Let me pray for a moment and find out.
Did you put your fingers to your temples and hum?
I should have done. I just looked at it like flabbergasted.
That
the camera's, you know, an inch from your face, so a little bit on the spot. You know, I came so close to saying, because you know, and it was kind of mean because he was so, you know, I mean, like, this is when he was very thin.
Uh-huh.
And I came so close to saying, well, he's looking pretty thin these days. I bet he's thinking about a sandwich.
Gosh.
Yeah. You would say that.
Luckily, I didn't. So I blurted out some other rubbish instead. But
your cult cast humor almost shined through on Bloomberg West. So Apple without Steve Jobs. Lander, what do you think? Are you happy with the direction they're headed? Are you worried still? We've had this conversation several times in the past. What do you think?
I look at the week this weekend with the iPhone 5S. I mean, 9 million phones sold over a weekend. They seem to be back as, you know, as strong as ever. Mm-hmm. And I think the interesting thing is what they're cooking up in the lab. And you know, the iWatch and any other products. I mean, you know, rumored 12-inch iPad,
mm-hmm.
All this stuff. You know, pretty sure they're looking at, and you know, it's an open question, obviously, when we're going to see these things. But you know, can they get those things out? Can they get them to the market and do a good job marketing them? You know, it's always really hard because Apple was always stumbling and always making mistakes, even under Steve.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, one of the things they did really well, Steve did really well, was responding to these mistakes, you know, like with the antenna gates. You know, I mean, they really, that was going to be that almost could have really damaged the company, I think,
mm-hmm.
because it was looking like a real PR bust. And the story became not about the success of the iPhone 4, but about how, you know, it dropped calls if you were holding it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Apple at the moment, I mean, like the advertising, I think, isn't very good. They don't have any really good marketing campaigns going on.
They need to bring back those Mac PC ads.
Yeah, those were great. You know what's great at the moment are those ads with the lazy iPhone, with your lazy smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like got that, those ones, man.
The big guy. Yeah. That's almost kind of a classic Apple ad, you know, where it's personified. Right. The technology is personified, and they're super clever. Right? I mean, they're very memorable. They're entertaining. So I don't know, you know, like I think the products, the thing, you know, with Steve was that he had a very unique position in the company and that he never, you know, he didn't write any of the code, didn't design any of the products, and he didn't even really give directive feedback, you know, mm-hmm. like when he criticized something, he would never say, he would point out what he thought was wrong about it, but he would never point to what they should do instead.
Mm-hmm.
He would just say, you could do better. It was always very non-directive.
Just kind of like inspiring them to go, you know, redouble their efforts.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course they, a lot of the, and so this is part of the Steve mythology and a lot of a lot of people knew that they were going to get, their work was going to get shut down. So they would carefully manage up. So Johnny did this a lot, you know, Johnny would always show him, they'd always show him three different alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
They would, and often they would only they'd show him something they already wanted him to pick. And they would get two sacrificial lambs. So they would get two projects or two versions that they knew he was going to reject.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally show him the one that they wanted him to pick. So they were tricking him. And, you know, he gets all this credit for being this genius that had this amazing taste. But, you know, in a lot of circumstances, and some of these are detailed in the new book, you know, he was being manipulated. Mm-hmm. By his staff.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he did have amazing taste, and he also knew how to push things. I mean, he would push, you know, the iPhone over its 2 or 3 year, 2.5 year development, 3 year development period. Mm-hmm. you know, I mean, almost didn't work. They had tons of problems. And it needs someone like Steve to keep pushing, you know, like to really drive this thing. And it's not clear whether that is still there at Apple. And also to manage everybody, you know, like, you know, he was a good, it was a team of sort of, you know, he had a team of equals. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them very strong personalities. Scott,
boy, that would be a great book title. Sorry,
a team of equals.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
And you know, Steve did a great job of like keeping everyone's, you know, ego and ambition and the sort of fiefdoms in check and making mm-hmm. sure they were all working together, all pulling, you know, in the same direction. And it's not clear whether, you know, that is still the case. Mm-hmm, it's mm-hmm. hard to imagine, really, with someone like Tim's temperament and personality that, you know, he has that same sort of iron fist that Steve had.
Right.
But I don't think it's showing. You know, there are no visible cracks. There's nothing to indicate, you know, that Apple is in trouble at all mm-hmm. or has stopped innovating. Mm-hmm. And it looks like they're doing some fascinating things behind the scenes. I mean, they're hiring all kinds of interesting designers from some really interesting discipline, from companies, you know, that this new guy they hired from Nike, mm-hmm. Who developed the Flyknit shoe. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy's a knitting expert.
Really?
He knows how to knit high tech materials. And the breakthrough there was to make, to put different, was to figure out a manufacturing process that used knitting with different, with materials with different, give it, you know, what do you call it? Tensile strengths. Mm-hmm. So they could put the structure into the top of the shoe into a single surface. Hmm. So the top of the shoe, I mean, like the problem, I think if you knit socks, you know, they would stretch in all different directions.
And I do.
Tube socks. So, do you knit those socks? What kind of socks do you knit? Like reindeer ones or?
Yeah, just Christmas ones all day, yeah. all year long. It's the only kind I do.
Anyway, he figured out how to make how to knit shoes that had structure in them in mm-hmm. the top, mm-hmm. and these are super form fitting. I mean, athletes love these shoes because they fit extremely snugly. Mm-hmm. And you know, so why does it's kind of, you know, the question is why does Johnny Ive want a guy like this? You know, mm-hmm. what are they cooking yeah. up? And of course, you know, I mean, we know they're looking at wearables. They also had a designer from Patagonia who was an expert in also knitting technology. They used knitting to create wetsuits. So, you know, it's intriguing. What are they up to?
The ice. It sounds like the ice sweater after I hear you describe it.
Exactly. And if they're just hiring these guys now, we're not uh-huh. going to see these products for at least 2 or 3 years. Because mm-hmm. that's how long it takes to get the production line set up.
I can't offer any detail and analysis like you just did, Leander, which is why we love having you on the show. All I'm armed with is my own opinion.
Your instinct. Well, what is your instinct?
My sharp as nails instinct. I've said this before. I think this is a really exciting time to be an Apple fan. And as you all know, I'm thrilled with Tim Cook. He deserves a lot of credit for stepping into Steve Jobs' shoes, which I can only imagine how daunting a task that must be, because he's like this just huge figure that's known worldwide. And I think Tim Cook has done an excellent job, and it is really exciting because we have new Mac Pros on the way. It does seem like Apple is still innovating, and we are at a critical point where I know when Steve left, he had helped participate in about 2 years worth of products. So we're at that point now where it seems like Apple is developing stuff without his input. And to your point, Leander, about him having that ability to really govern people and choose things that needed to be improved and, you know, motivate people to do better in their work, I think that's the critical piece, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's Apple's special sauce in a way, and the next year or two are really going to demonstrate what a post-Jobs Apple are going to be like. Yeah. And we're going to find out. I mean,
iOS 7, I think, is a good sign. You know, I think because you know, I've been using the beta for 2 or 3 months now, and I picked up my wife's iPhone the other day, and I was looking at iOS 6, and my God, it's like going back to Mac OS 6. You know, it looks really dated. It looks like from a previous era.
It does. Yeah, iOS 7 does feel incredibly modern.
Well, it's hard to, you don't really see it, I don't think. You know, you're not conscious of like, oh, wow, this is really modern. After you've been using it for a while, it's just when you look back and you look at what preceded it, it just does look really dated. And I think, you know, like Steve, I think, was, you know, given a lot of the blame for skeuomorphism. And, you know, I think he, you know, Johnny has shown that in software as well as hardware, you know, that he does have, that they're making the right decisions. I mean, it has a physics engine behind it. It's not fake 3D effects anymore. You know, the interaction engine is based on physics of the real world. Mm-hmm. And all this stuff is, you know, the sort of kind of brilliant design, you know, instincts. It was always accredited to Steve. Mm-hmm. But I think clearly is you know, permeates throughout the organization.
Alex, Buster, do you guys have anything that you want to add? I know Buster's just sitting there stroking his beard, nodding this entire time.
I don't know. Honestly, I kind of get tired of the whole argument of whether Apple will survive without Steve and stuff. But, I mean, I think the company is obviously doing pretty fine. And I think Tim Cook's been doing a commendable job so far without Steve.
I think once, like, the top-level executives that were there with Jobs start leaving is when you should get worried.
Right.
And, yeah, right. That's a good point.
I left, then, yeah.
Screwed. I've obviously, if I've leaves, that's...
That's going to be, catastrophic.
That's the biggest news since, I mean, the company was founded. I mean, I don't know how else to... Or since Steve Jobs came back. But, I mean, once you start... If people like Schiller and, you know, and Q and people like that, you know, Craig Federighi and people like that, if they start leaving or going somewhere else or, you know, retiring... then I think that's when you should start being worried. I think it's about the people.
Well, it's funny, they won't let him go, will they? Like Mansfield?
No. they won't let Bob Mansfield go. Yeah, I mean, he's been trying to leave for 2 years. they keep saying, Bob, you got to test out this iWatch and test out our fuel band and, you know, lose some pounds first.
Gym, right.
you're our test case.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sorry.
That man is svelte.
If Bob's listening to this, Bob,
svelte to the core.
I respect you, and you scare me.
Well, you know, the good news is I thought this was really cool, and this really did surprise me. The news that Apple has been rated the world's top brand, most recognizable brand. Just the brand value alone has been approximated to be about $98 billion. You know, ahead of Coca-Cola, that is incredible because Coke, I feel, spends most of their money just advertising and marketing and selling the image of Coke, whereas Apple, I feel, they do a lot of promotion and advertising, but their products are the marketing. And it's to have that kind of renown ahead of Coke, I think is a really huge deal.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. Yeah, and it's like a 10-year thing. I think it takes like 10 years to build a brand of that size. Mm-hmm. And this means that their brand is recognizable, you know, literally globally. I mean, everywhere. You can get a goat herder from Afghanistan and he'll be as familiar as with Apple.
He throws his Coke on the ground to come get your Apple product.
Exactly.
That's kind of incredible to think about in that way is that, I mean, Coke has been around for, what, 100 and something years?
Yeah.
And they advertise like crazy. I mean, every country you go to, you see Coke advertisements everywhere you go. And you don't see Apple advertisements everywhere you go.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, smaller countries, I've never seen an Apple ad Eastern Europe. I'm sure they're there now.
You see earbuds everywhere. And you see the Apple logo. And you see people using the products. And you see it on TV. And you see it in movies. And, you know, the products themselves, I think, are the best ads for Apple.
Yeah. I totally agree.
We got a really interesting post from an Indian college student. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys saw this sent in to us today. I was going to maybe make a post out of it, but he talks about how Apple is like, it's like the hot girl in high school that everyone wants to be with, but no one can actually ask out. Like, it's this global superstar that market really hasn't been able to tap into because of their price, but like they're so their brand is so like revered there.
In India, you mean?
In India, yeah, huh. And it's the same in China. I mean, and with the gold, that's why the gold, you know, 5S is selling out so quickly everywhere, is because it's this kind of status symbol.
Fascinating. I really love my Apple products, and I know it seems weird, but I feel like sometimes I get like an emotional high when I'm looking at my iPhone and using it. Am I the only one?
Yeah.
Yes.
And some yeah. That sometimes slight outside. Physical arousement. Am I the only one?
You need to go take a walk or something.
That doesn't happen to you guys. You gotta take a cold shower afterwards. Yeah, me either. I was just kidding. Hey, let's take a quick break before things get any more weird. And when we get back, if you've been having problems with your iMessage not working, I know I have been, and we discovered that this is actually a problem in iOS 7. We'll tell you how to fix it, and we're also going to tell you a little story about Samsung pulling shenanigans, and these are kind of crazy. These are even worse than when they were reportedly going through forums and talking about how crappy Apple products were. This is actually pretty crazy. So stick with us, y'all. We'll be right back. Stay in that seat. Hello, Governors. It's me, Irfan Elijah. Hey, I want to thank Squarespace for sponsoring this episode of the CultCast, and I want to tell you guys a little story about a friend of mine who recently signed up for their service. So he signs up for the service, right, and he forgot to use the discount code at checkout. So he was kind of bummed, but he hooked up with Squarespace support, and within moments, they had processed his refund for the extra money that he had paid. That's the kind of friendly, responsive customer service you can expect from Squarespace. They're really helpful, and they're always there to help you out when you get in a bind. But what's even better was, during the process of building his e-commerce website, he said to me, "Hey, you know, Irfan, this responsive design that you always talk about on CultCast, that actually works. My site looks awesome on my iPhone and my Mac." Yes, that's the truth. Upload your images, build your galleries, integrate your social media, all without touching any code, and bing, bong, boom, Squarespace makes your website look good on every device that comes around visiting. So if you need a website, maybe you're a photographer who needs to put some work on the web, maybe you're building a full-blown e-commerce website, give it a shot. Sign up for a free trial at squarespace.com/cultcast. Play around with Squarespace, get your site up. Now, if you like it, and I think that you're going to, you can save 10% off any purchase. That could be a month of hosting, a year of hosting. Just use the code CULTCAST10 at checkout. That's squarespace.com, and the code is CULTCAST10. Hey, you know, I really love Squarespace's service, and I'm thrilled that they're sponsoring yet another episode of the CULTCAST. Remember, when you support our sponsors, that makes them want to continue supporting us, which helps you, which helps them help you. Does that make sense? Let's just move on, shall we? Onwards to the show! All right, let's hop back into it. And we're back! Welcome back to the CultCast, everyone. Oh my goodness. So, have you guys been having problems with your iMessage? I know I have. I've been sending iMessages, and you know, the phone says that my messages are going through, but people just aren't getting the iMessages, and the phone doesn't tell you that they're not getting iMessages. And all my friends think that I hate them, and that's not cool because friends want to feel like they're loved.
Yeah.
So the only way I found to fix it was to reset my iPhone totally. And then when I reset, the messages usually would start working again. And then I would see that little red exclamation point next to the messages that shows that they haven't been sent. Have you guys been having any problems?
Yes.
No, a little bit. Yeah. Not a
just
ton.
I just had problems with it before the show started. I had to reboot my iPhone again.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. It happens to me probably once a day, if
Same
not
here.
More.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, Alex, are you intimately familiar with the fix for this?
Intimately, as in, yes, I've...
Can you tell the readers what to do to fix it?
Yeah, you should.
I mean, I can, but I'd much rather hear you talking about it.
You got to reset your network settings in the Settings app under the network tab. And... Mm-hmm. Or what I do is I just hold my home button and power button for a few seconds and the phone reboots really quick, and that does the same thing for me. But the bug is really annoying, right? Because it doesn't tell you that your message failed. So like you think you sent a text and you wonder why somebody hasn't texted you back, and you check it like 2 hours later and it's still sending inside the messages app.
Exactly.
Because it's what it's supposed to do is default to the text message thing. If the iMessage can't go through, it's supposed to just send it as an SMS. But for some reason, there's a bug, I guess, in iOS 7 that's what Apple's got to fix. So they said they're going to fix it in an update. I think it's planned for next week.
Yeah, I read that the phone was having trouble connecting to the iMessage server, so it hangs up in some way. I wasn't even showing that the message wasn't sent. My phone says the message was sent. So there's literally, unless I restarted my phone or had a conversation, you know, on the phone with somebody and say, did you get my text? There's no way I would know. So you may actually be having this problem and you may not know it. We did publish a little quick fix on it. And as Alex mentioned, you can go into settings, messages, and then you want to turn off iMessage and then reset your network settings. So go into settings, general, reset. And then re-enable iMessage. So go back to settings and then messages, re-enable it. And apparently that does fix the problem and you won't have to reset your iPhone anymore. But a fix is coming. Apple does know about it. And hopefully in the next update that will be fixed, because no one's going to do this fix. I mean, people listening to this show might, but the other 500 million people are just going to send iMessages and not know that it's not working. So there you go with that. Get your iMessage working again. Hey, so on to a little Samsung story. You guys probably heard about this. Samsung is pulling shenanigans on their Galaxy Note 3. Reportedly, Ars Technica was doing some research on the Samsung Galaxy Note 3. And they noticed that when they were doing certain tests to, you know, test the speed of like the processor and stuff, benchmark tests as they call them, that the phone would perform markedly better than it should have been. And they discovered that Samsung had written code into their phone to recognize when a benchmark test was being performed with all these different popular applications. And in response, it would boost the power on the CPU and the GPU so that the phone would perform better in tests. So people thought the phone was faster than it actually was. And I think that we should probably call the Samsung Galaxy Note the Scamsung Galaxy Bloat.
Zing! Wow. He's here all night, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I'm not actually, but you could take that one with you, give it to your friends. Have you guys you could claim it as your own. Have you guys heard anything about this? I mean, this is crazy, right? This is the kind of stuff that Samsung does allegedly, and you're like, really? This just seems so wacky that you would do this, because it seems like you would get caught. Why it just seems like they're trying to please the press, because we're the ones using these benchmark tests.
Well, what's interesting is Anantech did their own review of a lot of other smartphone manufacturers and found everybody else does it too, except Apple and Motorola.
Bastards.
I know, man. Yeah, like the HTC One, LG's phones, all of them do this exact same thing.
This is stranger than fiction. I never would have guessed that any company would do this. I mean, it's basically just to appease the press.
Right, yeah.
Alex.
No, I mean, even the companies stretch this stuff as much as they can. Apple does it too. When they say that battery life is whatever, all day battery life, or that's if like the stars align.
Yeah, if you have like brightness at low, Wi-Fi and yeah, Bluetooth, if you're like off and like just
got it running and you're doing nothing.
The notepad, that's it.
Yeah.
You'll get 15 hours of battery life if you use the notepad and nothing else once a day.
Yeah. So I mean, all of this needs to be, it's not all exact.
Well, it's not exact, but I mean, this is going out of your way to make it seem as though your phone is faster than it actually is.
Yeah, well.
It is shenanigans.
It's shenanigans.
It is. I mean,
shenanigans.
You should take a look at the full Anantech report too, because it's interesting on the state of tech or state of cheating Android benchmarks.
Scamsung. That's all I'm saying. Galaxy bloat. All right. Well, I think we should probably wrap it up there, fellows.
Okay.
I know you guys want to stay on and just talk, have girl talk, but let's wrap it up there because we're going to be inserting, well, I can just tell you now since you're at the very end of the show. So this is going to be the commencement speech, as many of you may have guessed, that Steve Jobs did at Stanford, I believe in 2005. It's about 15 minutes long, and boy, it is excellent. And Stanford gave me their permission to air it. And I'm really happy to share it all with you guys. So with that said, stay tuned until after the break, and we'll broadcast that. This has been the CallCast, the best 30-minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. Hey, make sure you guys go grab your copy of Cult of Mac magazine, available in the Newsstand app now. What, hey, Leander, what are we going to be talking about this week?
It's a Steve Jobs special memorial edition. So we've got some pretty good Steve Jobs features.
Awesome. There you have it. Perfect time for that, too. Hey, you can hang out with us on Twitter if you like. I'm at Airfon. Leander's L. Caney. Buster's BST3R. Alex is Alex E. Heath. And, of course, for all the best news reviews in the world of Apple, make sure you're following Cult of Mac. This has been the CallCast, the best 30-minute Apple conversation you're going to hear all week long. New episodes of the CallCast come out every Thursday night. I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you guys in just a moment. And then next time.
Hey, who won the Faves and Raves?
Oh, hey, congratulations, Buster. I hate you. You should die. He won by a long shot. Yeah, slow-mo.
What was Buster's pick?
He picked slow-mo.
So you got him.
Yeah, what a jerk.
This program is brought to you by Stanford University. Please visit us at stanford.edu.
Thank you. I'm honored to be with you today for your commencement from one of the finest universities in the world. Truth be told, I never graduated from college, and this is the closest I've ever gotten to a college graduation. Today, I want to tell you three stories from my life. That's it. No big deal. Just three stories. The first story is about connecting the dots. I dropped out of Reed College after the first 6 months, but then stayed around as a drop-in for another 18 months or so before I really quit. So why'd I drop out? It started before I was born. My biological mother was a young, unwed graduate student, and she decided to put me up for adoption. She felt very strongly that I should be adopted by college graduates, so everything was all set for me to be adopted at birth by a lawyer and his wife. Except that when I popped out, they decided at the last minute that they really wanted a girl. So my parents, who were on a waiting list, got a call in the middle of the night asking, "We've got an unexpected baby boy. Do you want him?" They said, "Of course." My biological mother found out later that my mother had never graduated from college and that my father had never graduated from high school. She refused to sign the final adoption papers. She only relented a few months later when my parents promised that I would go to college. This was the start in my life. And 17 years later, I did go to college. But I naively chose a college that was almost as expensive as Stanford. And all of my working class parents' savings were being spent on my college tuition. After 6 months, I couldn't see the value in it. I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life and no idea how college was going to help me figure it out. And here I was, spending all the money my parents had saved their entire life. So I decided to drop out and trust that it would all work out okay. It was pretty scary at the time, but looking back, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. The minute I dropped out, I could stop taking the required classes that didn't interest me and begin dropping in on the ones that looked far more interesting. It wasn't all romantic. I didn't have a dorm room, so I slept on the floor in friends' rooms. I returned Coke bottles for the 5-cent deposits to buy food with. And I would walk the 7 miles across town every Sunday night to get one good meal a week at the Hare Krishna temple. I loved it. And much of what I stumbled into by following my curiosity and intuition turned out to be priceless later on. Let me give you one example. Reed College at that time offered perhaps the best calligraphy instruction in the country. Throughout the campus, every poster, every label on every drawer was beautifully hand calligraphed. Because I had dropped out and didn't have to take the normal classes, I decided to take a calligraphy class to learn how to do this. I learned about serif and sans-serif typefaces, about varying the amount of space between different letter combinations, about what makes great typography great. It was beautiful, historical, artistically subtle in a way that science can't capture, and I found it fascinating. None of this had even a hope of any practical application in my life. But 10 years later, when we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me. And we designed it all into the Mac. It was the first computer with beautiful typography. If I had never dropped in on that single course in college, the Mac would have never had multiple typefaces or proportionally spaced fonts. And since Windows just copied the Mac, it's likely that no personal computer would have them. If I had never dropped out, I would have never dropped in on that calligraphy class, and personal computers might not have the wonderful typography that they do. Of course, it was impossible to connect the dots looking forward when I was in college, but it was very, very clear looking backwards 10 years later. Again, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. You have to trust in something, your gut, destiny, life, karma, whatever. Because believing that the dots will connect down the road will give you the confidence to follow your heart, even when it leads you off the well-worn path. And that will make all the difference. My second story is about love and loss. I was lucky. I found what I loved to do early in life. Woz and I started Apple in my parents' garage when I was 20. We worked hard, and in 10 years, Apple had grown from just the two of us in a garage into a $2 billion company with over 4,000 employees. We just released our finest creation, the Macintosh, a year earlier, and I'd just turned 30. And then I got fired. How can you get fired from a company you started? Well, as Apple grew, we hired someone who I thought was very talented to run the company with me. And for the first year or so, things went well. But then our visions of the future began to diverge, and eventually we had a falling out. When we did, our board of directors sided with him. And so at 30, I was out, and very publicly out. What had been the focus of my entire adult life was gone, and it was devastating. I really didn't know what to do for a few months. I felt that I had let the previous generation of entrepreneurs down, that I had dropped the baton as it was being passed to me. I met with David Packard and Bob Noyce and tried to apologize for screwing up so badly. I was a very public failure, and I even thought about running away from the valley. But something slowly began to dawn on me. I still loved what I did. The turn of events at Apple had not changed that one bit. I'd been rejected, but I was still in love. And so I decided to start over. I didn't see it then, but it turned out that getting fired from Apple was the best thing that could have ever happened to me. The heaviness of being successful was replaced by the lightness of being a beginner again, less sure about everything. It freed me to enter one of the most creative periods of my life. During the next 5 years, I started a company named Next, another company named Pixar, and fell in love with an amazing woman who would become my wife. Pixar went on to create the world's first computer animated feature film, Toy Story, and is now the most successful animation studio in the world. In a remarkable turn of events, Apple bought Next, and I returned to Apple, and the technology we developed at Next is at the heart of Apple's current renaissance. And Laureen and I have a wonderful family together. I'm pretty sure none of this would have happened if I hadn't been fired from Apple. It was awful tasting medicine, but I guess the patient needed it. Sometimes life's going to hit you in the head with a brick. Don't lose faith. I'm convinced that the only thing that kept me going was that I loved what I did. You've got to find what you love. And that is as true for work as it is for your lovers. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life. And the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do. If you haven't found it yet, keep looking and don't settle. As with all matters of the heart, you'll know when you find it. And like any great relationship, it just gets better and better as the years roll on. So keep looking. Don't settle. My third story is about death. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I've looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. About a year ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I had a scan at 7:30 in the morning, and it clearly showed a tumor on my pancreas. I didn't even know what a pancreas was. The doctors told me this was almost certainly a type of cancer that is incurable, and that I should expect to live no longer than 3 to 6 months. My doctor advised me to go home and get my affairs in order, which is doctor's code for prepare to die. It means to try and tell your kids everything you thought you'd have the next 10 years to tell them in just a few months. It means to make sure everything is buttoned up so that it will be as easy as possible for your family. It means to say your goodbyes. I live with that diagnosis all day. Later that evening, I had a biopsy where they stuck an endoscope down my throat, through my stomach and into my intestines, put a needle into my pancreas and got a few cells from the tumor. I was sedated, but my wife, who was there, told me that when they viewed the cells under a microscope, the doctors started crying because it turned out to be a very rare form of pancreatic cancer that is curable with surgery. I had the surgery, and thankfully, I'm fine now. This was the closest I've been to facing death, and I hope it's the closest I get for a few more decades. Having lived through it, I can now say this to you with a bit more certainty than when death was a useful but purely intellectual concept. No one wants to die. Even people who want to go to heaven don't want to die to get there. And yet, death is the destination we all share. No one has ever escaped it. And that is as it should be, because death is very likely the single best invention of life. It's life's change agent. It clears out the old to make way for the new. Right now, the new is you. But someday, not too long from now, you will gradually become the old and be cleared away. Sorry to be so dramatic, but it's quite true. Your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. Don't be trapped by dogma, which is living with the results of other people's thinking. Don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And most important, have the courage to follow your heart and intuition. They somehow already know what you truly want to become. Everything else is secondary. When I was young, there was an amazing publication called the Whole Earth Catalog, which was one of the Bibles of my generation. It was created by a fellow named Stuart Brand, not far from here in Menlo Park, and he brought it to life with his poetic touch. This was in the late 60s, before personal computers and desktop publishing, so it was all made with typewriters, scissors, and Polaroid cameras. It was sort of like Google in paperback form 35 years before Google came along. It was idealistic, overflowing with neat tools and great notions. Stuart and his team put out several issues of the Whole Earth Catalog, and then, when it had run its course, they put out a final issue. It was the mid-1970s, and I was your age. On the back cover of their final issue was a photograph of an early morning country road, the kind you might find yourself hitchhiking on if you were so adventurous. Beneath it were the words, "Stay hungry, stay foolish." It was their farewell message as they signed off. Stay hungry, stay foolish. And I have always wished that for myself. And now, as you graduate to begin anew, I wish that for you. Stay hungry, stay foolish. Thank you all very much.